Today on Wings, Sarah Schulman speaks about her nonfiction book titled Conflict Is Not Abuse.
So this book begins with something that so many things in our time begin with, a quote from James Baldwin. Not everything that is faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed until it is faced.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Sarah Schulman has won awards and fellowships. She's had a dozen novels published and several plays and screenplays produced. She's a distinguished professor at the City University of New York, and some of her nonfiction books are published by major university presses. But the book she speaks about in this program was published by a small press in Vancouver, Canada, Arsenal Pulp Press.
Nobody would publish this book in the States. And we've sold, I think, almost 10,000 copies in a year. It's in its fifth edition.
The book is titled Conflict Is Not Abuse, Overstating Harm, Community Responsibility, and the Duty of Repair. In November 2017, Schulman read from the book and talked with the audience in Vancouver for about an hour. Here are excerpts from that event.
No one can negotiate without being heard. Shunning, therefore, is designed to maintain a unilateral position of unmovable superiority by asserting one's status as abused and the implied consequential right to punish without terms. You have someone like Donald Trump who every single day tells us how abused he is, what a victim he is, and how it's a witch hunt, and it's so sad. Usually someone's telling the truth about him and his supremacy, and that's what he's referring to as an attack or abuse. At the same time, he's taking problems that are being experienced by the white working class in America who've had their jobs globalized by the white 1%, and he manipulates their anxieties and projects it onto immigrants, Muslims, and in last week, Haitians. As I began this book during the summer of 2014, we watched white police officers in Ferguson, Missouri and Staten Island, New York, murder two unarmed black men, Michael Brown and Eric Garner. We watched a rich and powerful professional football player, Ray Rice, beat his wife, Janae, unconscious in an elevator. We watched the Israeli government mass murder over 2,000 Palestinian civilians in Gaza. It quickly became apparent that the methods we've developed collectively to date to understand these kinds of actions in order to avoid them are not adequate. Now, as a novelist, in order to create characters that have integrity, I apply the principle that people do things for reasons. Even if they are not aware of those reasons, or even if they cannot accept that their actions are motivated instead of neutral and objective. Using this principle to examine those events, I have to ask myself what the white police officers, the wealthy football player, and the militarized nation state think is happening that produces and justifies their brutal actions. As video and witness accounts attest, neither Michael Brown nor Eric Garner did anything that justified the way they were treated by the police. Eric Garner sold loose cigarettes and Michael Brown walked down the street. Both men tried to offer the police alternatives to cruelty. Eric Garner informed the police of the consequences of their actions on him when he told them 11 times while in an illegal chokehold, "I can't breathe." Michael Brown raised his hands in a sign of surrender and said, "Don't shoot." But something occurred within the minds, impulses, and group identities of the white police officers, and there they saw threat gross enough to justify murder. We know from security camera footage taken in a casino lobby and elevator that Baltimore Ravens running back Ray Rice and his wife were having a quarrel. As much as we don't like quarrels with our partners and wish they wouldn't happen, Disagreement with one's lover is a normal part of human experience. It's impossible to live without it ever taking place. Yet Ray Rice experienced normal, regular conflict that exists in every relationship, family, and household in the world as so overwhelmingly unbearable and threatening that he hit his wife, knocking her unconscious, and dragged her limp body by the ankles out of the elevator, leaving her lying inert in a hallway. He looked at normal, everyday expression of difference, and he saw threat and responded with extreme cruelty. The Israeli government has kept the Palestinian Gaza Strip under siege since 2005. This has made daily life unbearable for its inhabitants. In the late spring of 2014, the government of Benjamin Netanyahu escalated pressure on the already suffering Palestinians, and some factions within Gaza responded with rockets that were of such poor quality they had only symbolic impact. The Israeli government re-reacted in turn to this response with over 50 days of aerial bombing and ground invasion, causing mass death and massive destruction of literal, cultural, and psychological infrastructure. The Gazans were resisting unbearable and unjustifiable treatment. The Israelis experienced this resistance as attack. From the most intimate relationship between two people to the power of the police to the crushing reality of occupation, these actors displayed distorted thinking in which justifiable behavior was understood as aggression. In this way, they overreacted at a level that produced tragedy, pain, and division. It is this moment of overreaction that I wish to examine. My thesis is that at many levels of human interaction, there is the opportunity to conflate discomfort with threat, to mistake internal anxiety for exterior danger, and in turn to escalate rather than resolve. I will show how this dynamic, whether between two individuals, between groups of people, between governments and civilians, or between nations, is a fundamental opportunity for either tragedy or peace. Conscious awareness of these political and emotional mechanisms gives us all a chance to face ourselves, to achieve recognition and understanding in order to avoid escalation towards unnecessary pain. Of course, it is not only the police, wealthy football players, or colonial occupiers who can feel abused in the absence of actual threat. It is not only the dominant who feel endangered when faced with normal conflict or when their own unjust actions are responded to with resistance. In fact, these distorted reactions occur in both the powerful and the weak, the supremacist and the traumatized, in society and in intimacy. In arenas in which real abuse could conceivably take place, there are those who feel persecuted and threatened even though they are not in danger, and they often lack help from those around them to differentiate between the possible and the actual. Bullies often conceptualize themselves as being under attack when they are the ones originating the pain. Everywhere we look, there is confusion between conflict and abuse. If a person cannot solve a conflict with a friend, how can they possibly contribute to larger efforts for peace? If we refuse to speak to a friend because we project our anxieties onto an email they wrote, how are we going to welcome refugees, immigrants, and the homeless into our communities? The values required for social repair are the same values required for personal repair. And so this discussion must begin in the most micro experience.
On Wings, you're listening to excerpts from a talk by Sarah Schulman, author of the book Conflict Is Not Abuse.
On a freezing snowy day in 2014, I was invited to a workshop run by social worker Catherine Hodes. A native New Yorker in her 50s, Hodes is an experienced professional with over 20 years of development and leadership in what was once known as the battered women's movement, but is now called intimate relationship abuse advocacy. Intimate abuse is a real crisis for New York. In 2014, the police received 284,000 intimate abuse calls in a year, which is about 800 a day, and made 46,000 intimate abuse arrests. Now, Hodes had boldly started to notice that clients were increasingly confused about what the word abuse actually means, that it was overused. The paradox is, of course, that many women are unable to recognize that they are being abused. And many women cannot get acknowledgement of this reality from others. Yet, at the very same time, Hodes also found that some women were applying the term abuse to situations that were really something else. Increasingly, she noticed that women who did not know how to resolve a problem sometimes describe that feeling with the word abuse. So this session had been convened to address that trend directly with service providers. While identifying abuse is essential to saving lives and providing services, differentiating conflict from abuse is also essential to meeting clients' real need to learn how to face and deal with obstacles and to develop truthful assessments of themselves and others. And she asks people like, are you in danger or are you angry, upset, and frustrated? If you say I'm angry, upset, and frustrated, you're not going to be like, oh, well, go home. We're going to deal with the fact that you're angry, upset, and frustrated. But we just want to know, like, is that what's happening or are you actually in danger? So that there's validation. Another thing she suggests is looking at the order of events. And this is something that I've tried to use for my, I mean, she says when a client comes in, she asks them for the order of events, and almost immediately she can tell whether it's abuse or conflict. So I started using order of events in my own problems. So I'll be like, well, first she did this to me, and then she did that, and then I, you know, whatever. And then she, so when I get to the part about me, I like smush it, you know what I mean? Like, and like if you have, if your friends help you go through the order of events and they don't let you smush it, you can find out where you have escalated, where you've contributed to creating the conflict. Well, obviously, significant abuse takes place where one person is being controlled by another or by a group in a manner that the recipient has not contributed to and cannot change. But the word abuse has become overused. People may feel angry, frustrated, upset. But this does not mean they are being abused. They could instead be in conflict. Therefore, the fact that one person is truly suffering does not inherently mean that the other party is to blame. People may not know how to make things better, how to look at their own participation, how to deal with feeling badly about themselves. They may not know how to understand their own actions and are afraid of the implications of their actions on the meaning of their lives. And this may be devastating, tormenting, and painful, but this is not being abused. It does not get resolved by organizing the punishment of another person. People may be part of negative friendships, families, or communities who attack outsiders instead of being self-critical. They may be receiving encouragement to blame and scapegoat others. They may live within groups, relationships, or families that do not tolerate the admission of mistakes and that reinforce supremacy ideologies about each other in order to maintain illusions of righteousness. This pressure, resulting in the action of collectively deflecting blame, does not mean that the person being blamed is abusive. In fact, it says nothing at all about that person, except that they are being blamed. Okay. So what's interesting is as we were doing this workshop with Hodes, she started to explain to us that increasingly perpetrators have seized the apparatus, the state apparatus that was designed to protect victims. She said that perpetrators increasingly are the first ones to call the police, to threaten legal action, to send lawyer letters, or threaten or seek restraining orders as part and parcel of their agenda of blame and unilateral control. And the National Coalition of Anti-Violence Programs 2014 report on LGBTQI intimate partner abuse noted that the police misarrested the survivor as the perpetrator of violence in over half of all queer domestic abuse arrests, misidentifying the perpetrator in same-sex relationships as the one who is butch, of color, not a mother, not a citizen, from another culture, or HIV positive. One of Hodes' many valuable suggestions is to lower the bar for what must happen in a person's life for their suffering to be acknowledged. Quote, "The current paradigm is encouraging all of us to think we are in abusive relationships," Hodes explained, "and if you are not in an abusive relationship, you don't deserve help. Being abused is what makes you eligible, but everyone deserves help when they reach out for it." This is a strikingly humane idea, that the collapse of conflict and abuse is partly the result of a punitive standard in which people are made desperate, yet ineligible, for compassion. So, like in 1958, when I was born in New York City, if a woman was raped, she could only get a conviction if she had what? Does anybody know?
A witness.
She had to have a witness. So at that period, the state was literally the enemy of women. And in the 1960s, when the feminist movement against male violence began, it was a movement that did not look for any kind of solution in the state. It had no expectations that the state would help women. In fact, there were very few women even in the state in terms of women lawyers and judges and this sort of thing. But also because that movement emerged at a time when globally there were a lot of revolutionary movements that were radically imagining transformations of our relationships to each other. There were post-colonial movements, gay liberation, women's liberation, black power, you know, radical movements with radical analyses. So when you look back at the 1960s feminist movement against male violence, you see that they attribute male violence against women and children to three things: patriarchy, poverty, and racism. So they saw it as structural. And their focus was not on punishing men. Their focus was on empowering women. So they did a lot of things that today we would call restorative justice, even though those words did not exist at that time. So for example, abortion was illegal. They organized, you know, illegal abortion networks. They taught women self-defense classes. There were rape crisis hotlines. If you were raped, you could call a number and a woman who had been raped would be on the other end. So these were solutions that were community-based. They did not involve the state. But the demand for these services was enormous, far more than a basic grassroots political movement could create. In the 1970s, the U.S. government started a program called CETA, where they would pay the salaries of people who ran these grassroots organizations. But in 1980, when Ronald Reagan was elected, and that's like D-Day for all the problems that are going on in the states right now, right? So one of the first things he did, I think it was in the first 3 weeks of office, was he eliminated CETA, and a lot of these programs fell apart. What you start to see in the 80s is that the government starts to take on this role. So the government is saying, we are now going to be the people who are going to be in charge of violence. So we have programs that are all dependent on government funding. In order to work in the programs, you have to have government credentials. But even more dramatically, there's a huge crisis of meaning because the U.S. government is one of the greatest sources of violence in the world. So they cannot be the people in charge of ending violence. Also, the enforcers of their policies are the police. But police officer is the occupation with the highest rate of domestic violence of any occupation in the United States, including football player. So police officers do not know how to solve problems, and they're the last people you should be calling if you have a problem. So what we're seeing is this movement from this idea that communities should be helping each other address these conflicts to it being embedded in the state. And there was a lot of propaganda for this in popular culture. So the 80s is when you start to see things like Law and Order Special Victims Unit, right? So every week on TV, you're seeing an episode where there's a completely pure and innocent victim, and there's a totally evil predator. And the answer is the police. But the American police do not know how to solve conflict. We see stories in the U.S. press. A guy is having a fight with his son. He calls the police. The police come. They kill the son. Calling the police when we're actually in conflict instead of abuse. We do it to show that we are the pure victim. and that we have no participation in escalating the conflict and we need the police. It's a performance of innocence. Because the way things are now is that the only way you get compassion from other people is if you're purely and completely innocent. But if we could allow a concept of our group relationships that allows people to be complex and to make mistakes and to show that they're contributing to escalating conflict without them being punished or shunned or humiliated, we would take back a lot of this power that we have as a community to try to address our own conflicts. Because what's going on right now, I think, is that the sign that we're being heard in our suffering is when the other person gets punished. These two things are completely linked, and they need to be separated. There needs to be a way that we can be heard, that we are authentically suffering and in pain, without the only proof of being heard being that somebody else is being hurt. You know, right now we define loyalty by meaning that we will join with the other people in our group to hurt the people who they say are their enemies or have been bad to them. That's how we define loyalty. And I'm amazed at how many times people ask me to hurt other people. They're like, why did you invite her? You shouldn't work with him. Don't go to that party, whatever it is. They're always telling you to isolate people, pretend they don't exist. Pretend that people that we're sharing the earth with are not there. You know, and that's the definition of loyalty. And I'm saying that real loyalty and real love and real friendship is when you say, how can I help you negotiate? How can I be there for you so that you can take responsibility for your part in creating this conflict? You know, like there's somebody who your clique had a falling out with like 5 years ago. And every time you see that person, you have a bad vibe with them. And then one day you realize you cannot remember what the incident was that you're still punishing this person for. At that point, just like say hi. You know, you see them, just say hi, how are you? You don't have to get into a big thing, but just like, who do we think that we make ourselves by hurting other people forever? Without terms, shunning without terms. There have to be terms. Like if you stole my money to buy drugs, I have the right to say, hey man, you can't come into my house until you have 3 years sober. I think that that's fair, but those are terms. But for me to say, no matter who you become and no matter what you do in your life, I'm never gonna treat you with respect again, that's absurd. It's about our self-image, that we have this idea that we are the good one, that we are the righteous one because the other is the specter, they hold all the evil. There's a lot of different reasons that we're suffering. And sometimes it is a direct consequence of that person's actions, but sometimes it comes from our histories. I mean, I was born in 1958, which is 13 years after the end of the Holocaust, right? And I was raised with a concept of profound oppression, of Jewish oppression. And you know, in 1944, 1945, Jews may have been the most oppressed people in the world. But in 1948, 3 little years later, when the Israeli state was founded, Zionists were able to seize control of the state apparatus and make another people, Palestinians, subordinate. So you have this going from extreme oppression, which has trauma that travels through generations. It doesn't suddenly end. And because of that history and that experience, people could not accept that they were now in an oppressor position. They could not emotionally accept who they really were in relationship to Palestinians and maintain this constant victim rhetoric. And you see the same thing with gay people. I mean, gay people who were profoundly oppressed, who lost their families, whose communities were decimated by AIDS because governments didn't care, who didn't have basic rights. And now we're in the homo nationalist period, where white gay people are invited into the state apparatus, joining the imperialist military. You know, this kind of white reconciliation between white gay people and white straight people to reinforce whiteness. And yet there's still a kind of a rhetoric that comes from the past that doesn't acknowledge how that whiteness that they were maybe once excluded from on a certain level is now fully informed. So to be up to date on who you really are, you can have, and just it's the same thing's true for individuals. As children, we could have had terrible experiences of being completely defenseless and not being able to protect ourselves and being manipulated and violated. But as adults, we may have more autonomy than we actually understand that we have because we're still living with the consequences of the past. having unresolved pain from the past and trying to make the present accountable for something that the present has not created, which I guess is the famous trigger. The problem of how to turn these things around is really hard. I know that, like, this book, I know that I've gotten a lot of crazy accusations against me online. Like, there was somebody who wrote, Sarah Schulman is a known abuser. She punched her girlfriend in the face and broke her nose. This never happened, by the way. You know, and then somebody else writes, what do you mean? How do you know that? And they go, it's well known. And then, like, there it is, you know, or then it's on Tumblr and it's shared 1,000 times. And then everyone's like, she's an abuser. You know, I mean, there's two questions that come from this. Is one, how do you stop it? And the only way to stop it is third party intervention. When people who are not you call up that person and say, you know, why are you doing this? If you have evidence, let me see it. If you don't, you know, this is really painful. And I don't want to be in a community where this is what's happening. We have to intervene. And this concept of third-party intervention comes from a book that I wrote called Ties That Bind, Familial Homophobia and Its Consequences. It was the first analysis of homophobia in the family. And it's when I realized that the queer person is alone in there, in the family, and that our queer communities do not intervene with homophobic families. We privilege the family. And that we have to let that go. We have to have third-party intervention where we call the family and say, listen, you know, this is a beloved person in this community, and the way you're treating them is not right. And we don't, you know, we don't want you to treat them that way. You have to step up and defend people, because if you're defending yourself, it's not going to change. There's a thing going around saying that my book is telling people to call the police. Okay, obviously, it's not doing that. It's doing the opposite, right? They never read it. And it's been shared like hundreds of times. And when I see it, I'll say, like, listen, do you want me to send you a copy of the book? Why don't you come to my, you know, discussion, or we can have a public discussion. They never come. You cannot have punishment without process, because this is how we all got stigmatized in the first place. Even if the process is painful, even if the process takes place in a group of friends, in a family, it doesn't have to be a state process. But just because someone is accused doesn't mean that they should be punished. I mean, it's really fun to watch these assholes get taken down. But, you know, who's firing them? The people who are firing them are just as bad as they are. And if a person really did do these things, what is appropriate punishment? You did X, you know, it could be rape, or it could be like asking someone to have sex with you. Right now, those are all the same. And if you do them, you lose your corporate job, and that's the punishment, and then it's over. But I'm not so sure that that's really the appropriate response either. You know, this kind of thing can trickle down, and it can get really messy, because pretty soon we're going to be saying, she broke her girlfriend's nose, you shouldn't let her read at your bookstore, and there's not going to be any kind of discussion.
Excerpts from a talk by Sarah Schulman, whose book Conflict Is Not Abuse, Overstating Harm, Community Responsibility, and the Duty of Repair, won the 2017 Judy Grahn Award for Lesbian Nonfiction. It's published in Vancouver, Canada, by Arsenal Pulp Press. Schulman was recorded by Robin Erickson. The talk was edited by Frieda Worden. To hear Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org, and please visit facebook.com/wingsradio. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle Is Cast. I'm Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.